And I'm going to go back to
love to visit.
that one. Okay. So,
All
can everyone online see the presentation?
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you, sir. And
Ah,
I'll turn
good.
off the backlights and I'll turn it over to Guy.
Where should I stand? Okay, so hi, I'm the current president of National Capital Astronomers, Guy Brandenburg, and this is our May meeting. We do this every month except during the summer. So our meeting in June will be about a month from today, and it's going to be primarily reports from Science Fair winners, and we have one with us today. So after the announcements and elections, because we have elections coming up, we're going to have a presentation by Julia Seitz from Fairfax County. Her schedule did not permit her to be with us next month. And the main presentation is going to be about the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. And our speaker is in the background. How many of you knew that Nancy Grace Roman, the namesake of this, was a member of NCA? Okay. Anybody didn't know that? Okay, it's true. She was a, yeah. We prepared for this. I looked at her bio on Wikipedia and I say, oh my God, she did that and that and that and that. In addition to being a science teacher in at Montgomery College, and she was treasurer of this organization. Her time on the board overlapped with my time as a trustee about 20 years ago. And if the weather permits, as you just heard, we will have observation with the telescopes. Okay, so announcements on sidewalk astronomy. Zach or Gael, do you want to say anything about that?
It's been going really well so far. We had a session last week. We had a turnout of like 100 or so, 150 people throughout the night.
Wow.
Yeah, we had the so my Dobsonian, Mr. Brandenburg's 8-inch Dobsonian, and also a 6mm refractor made from surplus shag glass as well that was being tested. It went really well. It's a lot of fun. I highly recommend it. It's really cool.
And we also got, I think, permission to go to what the waterfront in Georgetown, and setting up telescopes there during the daytime and the evening.
Nice.
We had a session at the CNO Canal a week or two ago, and that again, that just went really well. This is during the daytime.
And if you let me, Pete, if you let me know, tell me about it, and then I can put it on Night Sky Network, and we get brownie points
Yeah.
when we
I've
put these things on Night Sky Network, and
Okay.
especially if maybe there's a photograph or two.
Okay, well we put all right, we'll do that some more. Okay. Tell us about exploring the sky, Jay.
Okay, exploring the sky. We've had theoretically, two sessions so far, April and May, which were clouded out. If you don't have any, if you don't have the schedule for this year, I have some here and I can hand them out to you. They are at the field at the corner of Glover and Military Road, near the Nature Center. Again, if the sky's clear, this is a we've been doing this for what, 78 years. It is the oldest continuous astronomy observing program in the entire national park system. There are better observing sites that are advertised out west, but this is the oldest in the national park system. And I
What?
think beginning next month, at 8 o'clock, or about an hour before the observing, if you go to the Nature Center, you will be able to see a planetarium program for free.
And what's the date for the next one?
10th of June will be the next one. And as I say, I've got programs scheduled here if you want a schedule that I can give you afterwards.
Okay, thank you.
It can't be the 10th of June.
Yeah, I don't think it's the 10th of June. Might be the
The
3rd of June.
meeting's the 14th, so I think it's the 7th.
7th. 7th.
Oh, 7th of June.
No.
Oh, I
Seventh
don't
of
have I
June.
didn't have my glasses on.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, 7th of June.
Okay, thank you. And we can always use people with telescopes there. If the weather is clear, you get a lot of people.
Yes. And
On
even if you don't have a telescope and you're familiar with astronomy, we always need people to sort of help explain what it is up in the sky that they're seeing. And there's still, even though it's in the district, there's still lots of stuff that we can see. I mean, in November, I picked up, but with my electronic telescope, I picked up a comet.
Not bad.
Is
Questions?
that
Okay.
623 18?
Golf course lighting.
What?
You may or may not
That's
remember that
which?
there's a golf course a
Telescope?
bit to the east of our
Which?
observing site there. And there was a lot of back and forth about them cutting down a lot of trees and putting in a late night. What do you call it?
Driving range.
Driving range, exactly, illuminated. And there's good discussion between the Park Service people and people who are interested in preserving the night sky. And we'll get to that in number five. Number four, telescope making. That is ongoing again. What happened is apparently their system for registering courses in the Department of Parks and Recreation in the District of Columbia wasn't up to date. So they apparently have updated it. And so this is one of the few every week open houses for people to come in and work on the telescopes and fix their own or make a brand new one or just modify an old one. So that's still going on. It's Tuesdays and Fridays, starting at 6 to about 8:30. Concerning the mission statement, let's go to next slide, I think it is. Okay, we'll get to that in a minute. No. All right, so this was there's something called a Lights Out DC program campaign. And what they're asking, this is a coalition of different groups, including birding groups. And I wanted a nice statement. They wanted a nice statement for us that we would be on record as supporting this. And the idea is until the end of May and from, I think, mid-August to November, I don't remember the exact dates. They're asking people to turn off all outdoor lights on their houses or their business from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., specifically because that's when lots and lots of birds go by. So here's the possible mission statement that a number of us cranked out. It's a little different, a little bit more compact than what's on our webpage. It says National Capital Astronomers, NCA, was formed in Washington, D.C. 1937 to promote interest in and knowledge of the night sky, astronomy, and related sciences. Our free public lectures and telescope observing sessions and our telescope making and maintenance workshops help members of the public see with their own eyes and better understand our Earth, neighboring planets and galaxies, and the incredible scale of the universe. Our goal of helping Washingtonians see beyond the confines of our planet is seriously under threat from ever worsening light pollution. How many of you think that's a pretty good statement? Okay. Anybody think that is really messed up and needs changing?
There's some minor grammatical tweaks I would make,
Like, okay, we
but
can do
we can do it
grammatical.
offline.
Okay. All right. So I think we'll send that to them. All right. Let's go back one
Okay. Question.
thing.
Guy, yeah.
Question.
When I read that mission statement and I get to the end of it, our goal is seriously under threat. So What does our mission say we're going to do about that?
Okay. That part there would not be actually probably on our website. This was specifically something for the Lights Out DC campaign. There are a bunch of other groups like, you know, Audubon and so mm-hmm. on, and they were saying why they supported this particular program.
So this is a statement of support. It's not yes. intended to guide NCA's operations.
Mm-hmm. I think the first two paragraphs, yes.
Okay.
The second, the third paragraph, probably not.
Okay.
Yes.
Is it just Washingtonians? I mean, could it be visitors to the region or other interested parties?
Is it just Washingtonians or visitors and anyone in the area?
I think anybody in the area, but it, this is specifically Lights Out DC is the name of the campaign. But I know that there are similar things in Northern Virginia. And I don't know about Maryland, though.
You could say DMV or something, but we can go offline.
Okay, we can work on that. Okay, so now in terms of the officers, these are the people who have been nominated so far. I'll try to introduce them. Can we turn on the light for just a moment? So I'm the current president, and I've agreed to do it again, unless somebody else wants to step up and do it. And Brian, did you make it? Okay, that's Brian. Introduce, say a couple of sentences.
Sure. Great to meet you.
Stand up.
Right. I'm Brian Vanderbeck. I'm a Northern Virginia native, actually from Alexandria, Virginia. It's funny, I got into astronomy many, many years ago after watching the miniseries Cosmos by Carl Sagan. I'm sure a lot of you want this. I actually, a decade later, applied to Cornell University and got in, and then tried to register for Carl Sagan's planetary science class and got rejected because you had to be an astronomy major to get into the class. So I was kind of crushed about that. My life went in a different direction, but I did work at NASA for a couple summers as an internist with the telepresence technology they were developing for the Mars Pathfinder mission. But anyway, it's great to be back into astronomy after detours in photography and general aviation. And I look forward to, you know, working with you guys to find distinguished speakers for future events. But also, I'm sure we have lots of resident experts here. So if anybody wants to register to speak to the club, please talk to me as well.
And I also want to thank Carl Biagetti for doing an outstanding job as president. Okay, Secretary Treasurer Jim, did you make it? Okay, stand up and wave and say a couple words.
I was only drafted. I was volunteered by Guy to take over a couple of years ago as Secretary Treasurer, and so I've been balancing the books ever since.
And you're doing a great job. Thank you very much.
Anybody want to send me money?
So I went through and we've cross-correlated the current membership with the listserv people, and we're going to, I've provided him with all the current members who are not actually on the listserv.
Okay.
So
good. And we've put our membership person, Chong Wong, in charge of getting
maintaining that list. Yeah. Okay, good.
Let's see, Brian, did he make it online?
Brian, are you online?
I don't think so.
No, I don't see him.
So he's the backup person for Jim, and I'm sorry, we can't introduce him. And trustee is the four-year rotating term. He's going to be replacing, if he's elected, big suspense there, for Benson Simon. Benson, raise your hand. Thank you very much for being here. Thanks. Zach, say a few words.
Hey, all. I'm Zach. I'm a regular at the workshop over in Chip Chase Community Center, and I do sidewalk astronomy with Gail and Guy, and we're quite the group, and I'm honored to be with you guys. And I'm from California originally, been here 10 years, and I think DC can be the place for sidewalk astronomy in all the United States. So we want to get there. And building some pretty cool scopes too, and honored to be inspired for the role.
Yes. Thank you. Anybody else want to nominate themselves or anybody else or their enemies?
So we're now taking nominations from the floor.
Anybody have a nomination? I don't see any hands raised. Okay. Not seeing any other ones. I'm going to make a motion that we.
You're the president. Since it can't be you.
I move to accept the whole slate by acclamation.
I second. And now you can say.
Okay. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say no. Okay. So that.
So new people, if you can send me your information so I can update the website, you can see what's on there. You can have some leeway with what you post on there, but yeah.
Okay. Okay, let's go back to the agenda again. For the announcements.
No, it's
okay. So are there any other announcements? And I think you had an announcement. Jeff?
Me?
Yeah.
Yes. As many of you who have been around NCA for a while may remember, they used to gather at a local restaurant after the meeting and for dessert and conversation, coffee, dinner if you haven't eaten then already. We've been trying to, I see you already have coffee. We've been trying to revive this, especially since we're no longer going to dinner before the meetings. What we have decided to try this month is to gather, that there is a Silver Diner there over in Greenbelt. Now, it's very, very easy to get to. Make a right coming out of the observatory.
Okay, people left, can find it.
And then it's a straight shot down University Boulevard.
Okay.
So
Silver Diner Greenbelt.
Right. It's at the Beltway Plaza Mall, just before you get to Kenilworth Avenue. So
thank you.
Okay.
Anything else? Okay. Any other announcements? Okay. So we have a go to the one with the science fair. We have a with us, Julia Seitz, so why don't you come on up? And so here's the award that I gave her. I made for her.
Here it is.
Yeah. You're welcome. That's exactly that. Oh. We'll have to get a couple more signatures on here.
Don't
sit down.
Yeah, you can take that. Let's get a picture with you.
Well, I think, let's see. She's going to put us a little talk.
Thank you. Perfect. That's
good. So, I'm going to skip down here so I can hear.
So thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here. So, last year I did a project on the effects of artificial light on SkyGlow. So looking back on it, it was really simple, but I found that the more people in an area and more businesses, the brighter the sky became, resulting in less visible stars. This year, I kind of wanted to dig a little deeper, and I wanted to go further into states and hopefully internationals and with the science fair competition. So I wanted to see, knowing the effects of sky glow, what are cities trying to do about it? And if they are trying to do something, does it work? So I found that Tucson, Arizona dims their streetlights every night. So I asked my dad, hey, can we go to Arizona and see how that works? And he's like, no, you need to find something closer. So I found PRISM, which is a nonprofit organization aimed to helping municipalities dim their streetlights. So I reach out to the executive director and he tells me all about this program. And he gives me these three towns, Cumberland, Central Falls, and North Providence, and they all dim their streetlights at 11 by 50%. So I'm like, okay, that's so much better than Tucson. So I also found Preble, Massachusetts, aside from PRISM, but they also dim their streetlights at 11 by 50%. So over winter break, I go up with my dad, and he's my chauffeur, basically. I take 6 light meter measurements at every location. So this would see if the streetlights actually dimmed, and I could find out by what percentage. I also have an SQM meter, a sky quality meter, to measure the darkness of the night sky and see if the light pollution actually decreased. So First, what I did is I figured out the locations individually in each town. So I wanted to see like the range. So main street versus kind of like main city versus neighborhoods, just how, what is the main impact of it? So I start at 9 o'clock in Cumberland, and then I drive down to Central Falls and then drive down to North Providence all in the same night. The lights dimmed at 11 and I went back up. So I started around 9 and I ended around 2:30, which thank you, Dad, for doing all of that. I really appreciate it. But with all these measurements, I immediately noticed when the lights dimmed that the SQM meter increased. So the sky was darker. And obviously, the light meter decreased. So the street lights actually dimmed. So I was immediately impressed by this, but I had to put it through an Excel spreadsheet with these equations and see the percentage difference. So the next day, I go to Pepperell, Massachusetts, and I talk to the town manager. And there he talks all about this program, and he's really proud, and he's saving the environment and saving money, and the people have no complaints. And I also talked to the head of the MIT Observatory who lives in the town, and he told me about this program and how he's seeing less and less stars every year because of artificial light. So this really prompted me to be like, okay, I gotta do it in this town now. And I start at 9, I do 6 light meter measurements, 12 SQM measurements, the exact same in the other towns. The lights are supposed to dim at 11. And I go back through and I don't notice a difference. And I'm freaking out. I'm like, okay, the lights didn't turn off. And I start crying. I'm like hysterical. It's 5 degrees outside and it's like 1 in the morning. And I'm like, Dad, take me home. And he was like, no, you have to finish it. You got to see the end of it. So I saw no difference. So I
Is that
went.
in the SQM or is that in the lux?
This is it both in the lux and the SQM. So the street lights didn't dim and I saw no change in the SQM. So I talked to the town manager and I ask him, I email him, like, what happened? Like, did I miss the cutoff? Did the lights not actually dim? Like, what happened? And he got back to me saying that the engineers looked into it and that they have not been dimming their street lights for the past 6 months due to a software update that wiped their entire system. So immediately that like anxiety that I had that my project was ruined turned into kind of pride almost that I helped this town save their money and that they've re-implemented their program. So that became my control group because they didn't actually dim the street lights. So here are my equations that I put into the Excel spreadsheet when I went home. And I immediately found that there was an evident increase in SQM. So the sky actually got darker by about an average of 30%, which is great given that the lights were dimmed by 50% and it has a major impact. Also found that since Pepperell, there was no change in the SQM. That means that all of this difference is because of streetlights. So if buildings being like their lights being turned off or cars being turned off or people going to bed, that would have a noticeable difference in Pepperell. So all of this changes a lot because of streetlights. So I could talk for a long time about the environmental impacts of sky glow, but some people listen purely to economics. So I calculated how much each town was saving per night. And I eventually got that they saved 40,000 a year, which, given that their population is less than 30,000, is very significant. So I thought, okay, if New York dimmed half of their streetlights by 50%, they would save over $1 million a year, which could go towards any program that you can think of. So I also was able to calculate how much metric tons of CO2 that they were saving per year. And I calculated that they saved 227 metric tons, which is equivalent to 73 homes being charged with electricity per year, and a lot of other different things, like 229 acres of US forestry per year. So in the end, I found that streetlights have a major impact on reducing sky glow. So this summer, I want to go to different municipalities and organizations to talk about dimming streetlights. And that's as we introduce LEDs and replace high pressure sodium, that this technology can be implemented to help save the environment and money. So, thank you.
Okay, so does it make a difference whether they're using regular lights or whether they're using full cutoff fixtures, et
Definitely.
cetera?
So I would say full cutoff fixtures basically vary. You really need to have it towards the ground because if you have it
Yes,
go
sure.
straight up,
Yeah,
then you're
that's a
just
full
wasting
cutoff
it.
fixture,
Exactly.
yes.
So I think that dimming streetlights is obviously better than not dimming them. it would be definitely preferred to have them cut off.
Yeah.
But if they can't do that, I mean, I think dimming would
Yeah.
automatically be
Well,
better.
the full cutoff fixture
Yeah.
means that the light shines only down, it
Yes.
doesn't shine up.
Yes.
Julia, talk about Fredericksburg.
Oh, yes. So Fredericksburg, Virginia has high pressure sodium and they're slowly re-implementing LEDs. And they did, I think, half of their neighborhood. And I saw the before and after effects. And it was worse. It was so much worse. It was very dark, or not very dark, it was very bright. And just the lights looked just washed out and it was just terrible for the environment. So this summer, I'm planning on going to Fredericksburg and talking about the other half of their neighborhood that they're going to be implementing. And if they spend a couple hundred dollars, I believe, on every street light, they could be saving even more money in the future.
Yeah.
Yes.
So on the left-hand side, you've got the graphs of the blocks of Lux, is that where you're measuring directly at the
Yes,
street
that was
light?
directly under the street light.
Right. So I guess the orange one is when they're at full strength, and the blue and the
The yes,
red
I can explain.
are at when they turn
Yes,
stuff
so
off.
the I don't know if you can see it, but the orange right here is when I've measured them before, and then the blue is right after they dimmed, and the purple is what I expected. So the town manager told me, or not the town manager, sorry, the prism director told me about the percentage that it would change, 50%. So these numbers are what I expected. So of course, like human error, if I like shifted it just a little bit, it was going to be a little bit off, but it was about where I thought it would be.
Okay, so the first three it definitely reduced, and obviously in Pepperell it
Yeah,
didn't.
they didn't. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Thank you.
Yes.
Actually, a question. Is anyone looking at the spectrum of these LED lights? Because I like the fact that they use a lot less electricity than the incandescent, right though. But like as a photographer, I hate the fact that I can't block them with filters as
Yeah.
easily, right? But they also ruin your night vision because they're so
Exactly.
blue, right? Is anyone looking at that and trying to shift the or limit the
I
spectral response to these LEDs?
was actually surprised that there were no information on this.
Wow.
That I believe there
Yeah.
was one study like 5 years ago in Tucson that didn't go as in depth that I thought it would,
Okay.
but it did talk about obviously you want to have like what is it, cooler temperature?
Yes. Yeah.
You
You
want to have
want
cooler
something
temperature.
3,000 degrees or lower.
Yes.
Go to the Natural History Museum at Air and Space. They've got an exhibit there
Yes.
on light pollution.
It's
They
actually
also
in
have
the
the
Natural
natural
History
history.
Museum.
Is that what I said?
Yeah.
Yeah, but then you said Air and Space.
Oh, no, I don't mean Air and Space. I meant Natural History.
Oh, when I did my project last year, I talked to the two people in charge of that, and they
Yeah.
were very
Yeah.
proactive about this.
Yeah.
So I was actually really surprised about how little towns are doing about this because they
Yeah.
could save so much money in the
Yeah.
end. Yes.
I'm not familiar with where all these towns are,
Yes.
but are they isolated or are there large municipalities nearby?
So these three towns are right outside Providence, Rhode Island.
Okay.
And then Pepperell is basically like Vermont. It's
Okay.
very, very close to Vermont.
So all three of the first ones though have towns nearby, which would
Yes.
be contributing to Skyglow.
Yes,
Okay.
definitely.
So,
Yeah. Yes.
you mentioned prism. Is that I tried to look it up while you were talking, and I couldn't find it.
Okay.
Is it prism.org or
I
what?
have no idea. It's PRISM. It's the Rhode Island, it's a municipality organization that aims to help reduce Skyglow. My dad seems to be looking it up right
I'll find it.
now.
Thank
Okay. I need a
you. So Prism is a it's a nonprofit semi-governmental organization set up in the state of Rhode Island to manage the streetlights in the municipalities in the state of Rhode Island. And cities basically contract with this nonprofit to buy the streetlights from the electric company, and then Prism manages it for them and gives them some options on dimming and some other things as they transition to the LEDs.
Okay, color temperature.
There are some options, I believe, when they transition to the LEDs about the color temperature
Yeah,
as
we
well.
had a big thing about color temperature here in DC.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, just so you know, all of our science fair winners It's a NCA swag. What did you order?
I ordered the blue one.
Okay, that came. Right?
Yes, it did. Thank you.
But your subscription to Spanning Telescope probably hasn't started yet.
I don't think so.
Got to do that. they're going to be joining us after this. Your subscription to Spanella's newsletter.
Thank you.
Should I stand here?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, so we already mentioned that Nancy Grace Roman was a member of this group. She was NASA's first chief astronomer, and in NASA circles, she's known as the mother of Hubble. Not Edwin Hubble, but Hubble Space Telescope. This discussion, the email that Guy sent out yesterday, President Guy, talking about Nancy Grace Roman, prompted me to look on the Stardust website, the Stardust, what's it called, listing of meetings.
Okay.
I guess it's the archive, yeah, which is a great page. It has entries for every meeting that's
published.
The spreadsheet. It has entries for every meeting this club has had all the way back to 1943, listing the speaker, the subject, and the current officers at that time. It's a very interesting history, actually, just with that information. But so I looked up, I searched on Nancy Grace Roman, and turns out she spoke to this group, in addition to being a member for some years. She spoke to this group a total of five times, the first of which was in December of 1960. She spoke on orbiting astronomical observatories.
1960.
Now, I'm old enough to remember 1960. I think a few of us are in this room. And correct me if I'm wrong, but there weren't any orbiting astronomical observatories in 1960.
They barely put Sputnik
in. Yeah, that's right. It was just a couple of years after Sputnik. So her talk must have been completely predictive and forward-looking. I wonder if if she described some future observatory that maybe is similar to the eponymous one that we're going to talk about tonight. I don't think that talk is archived in any way. So it'd be interesting to see what she had to say. So anyway, there's a through line of sorts from Nancy Grace Roman to the National Capital Astronomers to our speaker tonight, Dr. Rob Zellum from Goddard Space Flight Center. Give us a talk tonight on Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. Rob is a deputy project scientist on Roman, and you also worked on the science calibration program,
Yeah, on one of the instruments.
I know those science calibration programs never really end.
I would like a job, so jobs are great.
Yeah, right.
I like a paycheck.
And two other things in your bio caught my attention. One was the Pandora project, mm-hmm. where you use a small satellite to look at several stars and their exoplanets.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was Exoplanet Watch, I think it was called, which is a citizen science effort to observe exoplanet transits in an effort to refine their ephemerides, to refine the transit times. And the reason that caught my eye was because last month at this very meeting, that subject came up. We're talking about JWST, and it was important to know within a few minutes, plus or minus a few minutes, when a transit is actually going to occur, so you don't run the risk of missing the observation or wasting telescope time.
Yeah, I'd love to come back and talk about that for sure, and Pandora and Exoplanet Watch. That'd be incredible.
Great.
Sign me up, please.
Okay, good. Sounds great. So over the last few years, we've just one more thing. Over the last few years, we've had a couple of talks on the Roman Space Telescope, but over the last 4 or 5 years, I guess. But over that same intervening time, there's been a tremendous amount of new science and data. In that time frame, JWST has been launched and has been doing great science, as well as several other missions. And so I think that data must help to refine Roman's science goals and the actual observations and proposals be done. So, Dr. Zellum.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, everyone. Appreciate it. Do you want to share audio through your laptop or do you want to be through my laptop? Up to you.
We'll do it through mine.
Perfect.
Since it's recording.
Yeah. Cool. Sounds great. All right. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming out. Really appreciate it. I made the long trek from Southern College Park, Northern Hyattsville. So it was a very big slog to come out here. I didn't have to take the beltway at all. Very spoiled. I love living in this area. It's great. So I just came here actually about a year ago from Los Angeles, from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where I worked on the coronagraph, one of the two instruments on board of Roman. And I thought that I loved nice weather. All right, I got tired of nice weather too much. Palm trees were overwhelming. Tacos were too good out there. And so I decided to come out east out here at Goddard. So I've been at Goddard for almost a year. It'll be about a year and about a week and a half. And I'm really excited, really happy to be out here on the East Coast. I grew up on the East Coast in Tennessee. My wife is from Florida. So it's nice to feel humidity again. I know I'll be regretting that in about a month or two. But for now, I'm enjoying not having to put hand moisturizer on every 5 seconds. So, yeah. So I'm Vanessa Goddard. I work on the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. I'm one of many deputy product scientists on the missions. This is NASA's next flagship observatory astrophysics mission. It's launching no later than May of 2027, and perhaps as early as October of 2026. Next year, we might be launching the space telescope. So before we talk about the Roman Space Telescope, as you've heard before, it's always good to talk about Nancy Grace Roman herself. She's NASA's first chief astronomer. She was also the first female executive at NASA. As you heard in the intro, she's also sometimes referred to as the mother of the Hubble Space Telescope because she was one of the main proponents of getting Hubble launched. Back in the day, astronomers said, hey, we have great observatories like Palomar and other awesome ground-based telescopes. Why are we going to spend millions or billions of dollars to build a space observatory? Roman was one of the big proponents to convincing the field of other professional astronomers that making that investment was worth making a space-based telescope. She was also able to convince Congress to foot the bill and also the general public to rally behind. So we really have her to thank in large part for the Hubble Space Telescope today. So as I mentioned before, Hubble or Roman is the next line in one of many great observatories. So right off the edge of my slide here, sorry about that, is the Hubble Space Telescope, launched in 1990. That had its 35th anniversary about 2 weeks ago, last week or 2 weeks. I don't know, time is
24th.
There we go. Who knows what time is ever since COVID. Anyway, so about 35 years, Hubble's been in space. We've had the Chandra X-ray Observatory, Spitzer, a near-infrared to mid-infrared observatory that was retired in 2020 in January. The Hubble James Webb Space Telescope launched on Christmas Day, December 25th, 2021. And then we're up for the next one, NASA's Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, launching no later than May of 2027, and perhaps as early as this coming fall. So to compare Roman with the other observatories that we have, right here, Roman is the same size as the Hubble Space Telescope. So Roman is a 2.4-meter telescope, just like Hubble. James Webb is a 6.5-meter telescope, so a bit larger, has that segmented mirror. Roman and Hubble both have those monolithic mirrors. So Roman, since it has the same size or amount of light gathering power as the Hubble Space Telescope, has the same precision as Hubble, same sort of size bucket to collect all those lovely photons. Roman, however, has a focal length half that of Hubble's. So Roman's roughly twice as fast as Hubble, so it has a larger field of view. And coupled with that, Roman has this giant detector array that I'll talk about in a few minutes that enables Roman to have a giant field of view, to use technical terms here. Roman's field of view is 1 to 200 times larger than Hubble or James Webb. So Roman will be out at L2. Roman will have access to over half the sky at any given time. Roman has faster slew and settle rates than Hubble. So Roman can do Hubble quality science 1,000 times faster. So Roman is very complementary still both to James Webb and Hubble. So for example, let's say we look at something really cool with James Webb. James Webb is sort of like our view, our zoom lens on our camera, right? It goes very deep. It goes also a relatively narrow field of view. Roman is our fisheye lens. It gives us that large field of view. It gives us the context of our James Webb Space Telescope observations. So you can look at something cool with James Webb and then follow it up with Roman and get a better context. Alternatively, we can look at something really cool with Roman in its survey mode, then observe it in greater detail at a pinpoint with James Webb. Roman is not going to replace the Hubble Space Telescope, to be abundantly clear. So Hubble is the only telescope that we currently have that gives us access to ultraviolet light. Roman is operating from 0.5 to 2.3 microns. This is the visible to the near infrared. James Webb is about 0.6, 0.9 to about 15 microns or so, if I'm remembering those numbers correctly right now. Hubble goes to the UV out to the near infrared. So all three of these telescopes have different wavelength capabilities that are very complementary to each other. So I hope that we keep Hubble alive to keep us giving access to UV radiation. So some fun facts from Roman. Again, we're launching no later than May of 2027. We thou shall not launch any later than May of 2027. That's literally what we have to do. We have a 5-year minimum mission. The mission's being built towards 10 years to give us a lot of overhead, just in cases. We're launching out to L2. That's the second Lagrange point. This is the same point where the James Webb Space Telescope is. So 930,000 miles or 1.5 million kilometers away. And it has a pretty large primary mirror, about 8 foot across, 410 pounds. That's about the quarter of the size of the Hubble Space Telescope in its mass, because of all the technological advances that folks have made in the last 35 years. So Roman, despite being the same size as Hubble, is about a quarter of the mass of Hubble as well. Yeah.
At L2, does it do any kind of orbit around L2 the way James Webb does?
Yeah, so the question for folks online is, does it do a similar orbit that around L2 that James Webb does? And yes, exactly. So Roman has only one expendable on board. That's its liquid hydrogen gas, and that gets us from low Earth orbit out to L2. And we need that to maintain our orbit in L2, to stay at L2. L2 is kind of like a saddle. It's not fully gravitationally stable. So to keep us in L2, we need that liquid propellant. Roman is otherwise largely solar powered. You can see the solar panels at the top of this photo. But one cool thing about Roman is it basically has a gas cap on board. So just like, you go to Wawa, you get some more gas, right? I'm sorry, I love Wawas. I went to school at Villanova, so I'm excited about the new Pope because he also went to Villanova. So I'm like a degree of separation from the Pope, which is kind of cool. But also, I miss cheesesteaks
Well,
and Wawas. Oh, sorry. We'll ignore that comment. We'll talk about hoagies a little bit and cheesesteaks. So I'm excited to be back on the East Coast by Wawas again because of Philly. So just like, I don't know, there's a sort of example of getting us into gas caps. Anywho, so Roman has a gas cap on board. So if NASA wanted to, it could build a robotic mission to go out and refuel Roman. So potentially, if NASA wanted to spend the money and invest in it, they could build a future mission to extend Roman's lifetime even further. So we have a 5-year minimum. We're building to 10. But hopefully, if we use the liquid propellant on board, we can even use it more efficiently, and we can extend the lifetime even more beyond that, just like what they did with James Webb. James Webb was built for 10 years. They used their liquid propellant on board a lot more efficiently, and now they think it's going to last at least 20 years, which is pretty exciting. So Roman's a little bit different than Hubble and James Webb. They operate more like classical observatories, where astronomers will write a proposal, they'll submit it to a group of astronomers, and then they'll figure out, you know, what time to award to what studies, what proposed science. Roman is more of a general astrophysics survey machine. So Roman, most of its time, about 80% of its time, if not more, will be spent doing infrared wide area surveys. So what's really cool about that is Roman's sort of observing is set ahead of time. It's not set by astronomers in that classical observatory sense. What's tied to that as well is that all the data will be immediately public. So anyone in this room, anyone in the world can get the data as quickly as I can. I work on the mission, which is really cool. So Roman, being this infrared survey machine, it has two instruments on board. One is this wide field instrument, and the other is the chronograph instrument. I was really lucky to work on the chronograph instrument at JPL out in LA the last 6 years or so. And now I'm working on the wide field instrument here at NASA Goddard. Most of the observing time will be spent on WFI, and about maybe 2 to 5% of the time will be spent on the chronograph. And I'll explain why a little bit later. But a majority of our science and our observations will be coming from our wide field instruments. Right here, you can sort of see an image of our focal plane. This is the meat and potatoes of the wide field instruments. It's 18 H4RGs. These are infrared detectors that go from 0.5 to 2.3 microns, the visible to the near infrared. Each of those is about the size of a saltine cracker. There's 18 of them as well. This is one of the reasons why we have that ginormous field of view. This, compounded with the shorter focal length, gives us that giant field of view that Roman has. There's 18 of them, very similar to the technology that's in your cell phone camera, except just a little bit more expensive, maybe. And there's 18 of them. This gives us a 300 megapixel camera. Again, 1 to 200 times the field of view of Hubble and James Webb. It does photometry. It also has spectroscopic capabilities as well. So we'll do things like looking at Doppler shifts of galaxies, for example, the spectrographs. We're using the photometry capabilities on board to look for type 1A supernovas, which I'll talk about in a second as well.
So that's the symbol of the telescope.
And yeah, exactly. And that's the logo of our telescope branding, hashtag branding. That's the main logo of the Roman Space Telescope is WFI. And I'll talk about that, in a minute. I did get a question too.
Yeah, really quickly. I'm just wondering, is there a particular reason why the detectors are not laid out in a rectangle?
I love when people ask this question. Yeah. So the question for folks online is, why do you have that weird space invader shape? I think that's the exact language you use.
The ghost from Pac-Man.
Yeah, or the ghost from Pac-Man, as opposed to a rectangle. That's to avoid vignetting from the primary mirror, actually. Okay. So if we moved and had like a rectangle, mm-hmm. and this detector was higher up, then we would get to the edge of the primary mirror. That means lower throughput, gotcha. Which means reduced SNR. So we basically, this mimics the curvature, the outer diameter of our primary mirror. Great questions. Another question that you might ask, go ahead, we'll see if I can predict.
Is the reason why that shape is because the coronagraph takes the rest of the coronagraph?
No. The coronagraph actually is like observing down here.
Right.
So it's a little different part of the optical beam train. Just that shape is purely to give us that wide field of view. And to maintain that wide field of view, but giving us a large throughput to maintain high SNR, we've shifted out those last two columns, basically, mm-hmm. to edge us away from the edge of the primary mirror to keep that throughput high. Another question I usually get from folks is, why is there a bigger gap here at the bottom row than the top row? And that's because it's the readout electronics. So this detector, for example, the readout amplifier, where it takes the pixel information, sends it out to the computer. That's the top of this chip. This chip's pixel amplifier is at the bottom, and that's a little bit bigger. You can kind of see it right here. That causes that gap between the second and the third rows. Yeah.
Wait, so If that's on the top of the prime mirror, then what's on the sides? We don't just like waste all that light, no?
You're wasting the spatial information, but you're still collecting all that light.
Oh. And if I remember correctly, Hubble's focal ratio was around, or actually F27 or F24. This is around F10, right?
Yeah, roughly around there. Yep. I think you had a question too.
So why is it so apparently so far off to the edge of the field rather than more or less centered?
To maintain the high throughput? Yeah. So if we go towards the center, we run in towards the obscuration of the secondary mirror and the cutout from there.
Oh, okay.
And also it's the design of the instrumentation itself. I'll show a photo in a minute of the actual flight hardware, and you can sort of see where the instrument is nestled into the optical beam train. You can sort of see there too. These are great questions, folks. Thanks for challenging that Saturday night. Yeah, go ahead.
Given your 300 megapixel camera, what is your sound? What's your downlink look like?
You guys are asking lots of amazing questions. So each of these images is half a gigabyte big.
Oh, Jesus.
500 megabytes big. We downlink every single day, if not every 8 hours. Mm. And we downlink 1 terabyte of data a day.
Oh, Jesus.
So one gaming computer, one MacBook Pro, it's worth of data a day. And it's all through the K-band, the KS band. We do not use the deep space network. That's what James Webb uses. That's what a lot of planetary missions use. They'll use this radio network of telescopes in Spain, Southwest America, like in California, and then Canberra in Australia. Mm-hmm. Since Rome is downlinking so much data, we have our own dedicated ground-based network. Japan, America, and Spain, I think, as well. Yeah. You guys are challenging me, keeping me on my toes. I should drink more coffee. This is great. All right. So that was the wide field instrument. That's our primary instrument. About 95% of Roman's time will be spent observing with this instrument. The chronograph instrument, this is what I've been working on at JPL before coming out here to Goddard. This is what's called a technology demonstration. So direct imaging is where we're actually able to block out the light of a star, but also still resolve the light of a planet orbiting around that star. So it's a lot like, how many of you were lucky enough to see the total solar eclipse a few years ago? Nice. I was stuck in a lab that entire day. Uh-huh. I woke up, I saw the eclipse starting to happen, and I went to work and was stuck in a lab all day. So lucky all y'all, I'm jealous. During the total solar eclipse, if you were in totality, you were lucky enough to see the corona. You could see some stars around the sun as well. Well, astronomers realized how important solar eclipses were to observing the outer corona, this observing stars around the sun, but they had lack of funding, they couldn't travel. Sounds kind of familiar, right? And they realized how important that was. They also got impatient, also sounds very familiar. So they built something called a coronagraph that would simulate a solar eclipse, block out the sun's light, and cause that solar eclipse to happen. We're using that same technology more or less 100 years later today. But instead of simulating a solar eclipse on our own sun, we're doing that on stars, stars outside of our own solar system. We're blocking out the light of those stars, and we're observing the planets orbiting around those stars. This has typically been done on 5 meter class telescopes on the ground. The smallest that I'm aware of is Palomar, the Hale Telescope, 200 inch in Escondido, California. And larger instrumentation as well. We'll be demonstrating that technology that's worked so well on ground-based telescopes in space for the first time ever. So this will be demonstrating that technology in space for the first time. And this will be a precursor to NASA's next flagship mission, NASA's Habitable Worlds Observatory. The project office just started at Goddard last fall. I'll be launching about 15 to 20 years from now, and that'll be designed to look at Earth-like planets and to look for signs of life. So from the Roman coronagraph, we'll be learning all those lessons, what to do, what not to do, what sort of hardware to use, what sort of software to use, downlinks, observing campaign sequences, calibrations. We'll learn that from Roman and apply that to Habworlds. So right here's a picture of the coronagraph. There's my friend, colleague, Vanessa Bailey. She's the coronagraph instrument technologist. There's CGI, the chronograph right there. It's about the size of a baby grand piano. So Roman as itself is about the size of a tour bus.
They're absolutely massive. I always forget how ginormous these space telescopes are. So here's actually some really cool flight hardware photos. These were taken about 2 to 3 months ago. They're already out of date, honestly, because things are changing all the time at Goddard. Every single piece of flight hardware for Roman is at Goddard. Roman is largely completely built together. It's now undergoing environmental testing. I still love showing these photos because you can sort of see what it's being built. This image was taken the day our primary mirror was delivered to us by L3 Harris from Rochester, New York. There's the mirror. On Roman, we have lots of terrible Roman puns. So this is the Roman chariot. Yep, right here. This thing in the back is the Pantheon. Yes. So right here is our primary mirror, 2.5 meters across in the chariot. Roman will then be put back into this and shipped down to Cape Canaveral. Kennedy Space Center will be launched. Yeah, question.
Of course, as everyone is familiar, Hubble had a small problem with correction. Roman is correct.
For those online, I knocked on wood.
I volunteered Air and Space, and we have the correct one.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's why Roman, one of the lessons learned, I guess, from that is that we have opportunities to focus on flight. On orbit, but also we're doing intense testing. So Roman is undergoing testing at every single individual level. So for example, when I was at JPL and I was working on the chronograph, we did our own thermal vacuum chamber testing, our own vibration testing, our own electronics testing for a few months. Then the chronograph was delivered out to Goddard and we did them again. So everything's been tested multiple times through thermal vacuum chamber testing, through electronics testing, through vibration testing, tested and tested and tested and tested, so that hopefully, knock on wood, everything will go swimmingly when it's launched. Yeah. So right here is our primary mirror on delivery day. Right here, there's the Roman Pantheon. On top of that is the spacecraft bus. That basically gets us from Earth out to L2. That contains our star trackers, our reaction wheels to help orient us or pointing. It has our fuel tanks on board. It has our high gain antenna to transfer data back to Earth. Right here, the silver thing on the far left is our deployable aperture cover. This is our sun shield. It actually sort of pops out just like origami does, so it can fit in the nose cone fairing of the rocket. For you guys in the room, unfortunately, just to the right is the instrument carrier. I'll show a better picture of it in a second. Here's the wide field instrument on the far right. So let's go take a look at that stuff. Here is our spacecraft integrated payload assembly. So this is basically the meat and potatoes part of Roman. Here's our primary mirror at the top with our secondary. Here's the chronograph on the right. For folks online, it is, move this. It is this thing for folks online. Right here, you can barely see the wide field instrument peeking its head over the primary mirror. Right here, there's a rector set slash jungle gym. That is our instrument carrier. And below that is our spacecraft bus. Again, it contains the high gain antenna, the star trackers, all that fun stuff. So this is our spacecraft integrated payload assembly. Right now, this is undergoing thermal, actually, no, it's going under vibration testing right now. It just got finished with thermal vacuum chamber testing. If you go on our social medias on Instagram and Face page and Twitters and all that stuff, we have a really cool news story that was just released a few days ago that shows this piece of flight hardware in our thermal vacuum chamber at Goddard. So stuff is being tested right now, environmental testing, and it's only a matter of time that it'll look like this. Potentially at the end of this year, if not by the end, by next summer, Roman will be fully integrated and ready to be shipped out from here out to Cape Canaveral, the Kennedy Space Center. Here first. So let's talk about science with Roman. Roman, again, is that sort of general infrared survey machine, and it'll be conducting a ton of science. If you do infrared science and you love Hubble quality data, Roman will definitely be for you. One of the things we'll be doing is I'm an exoplanet scientist by trade, so I'm very excited about this science case, is Roman will be discovering thousands of planets. Today, we know of only about 6,000 planets to date. Roman is predicted to discover tens, if not hundreds of thousands of planets. And
Why that's really important is because it'll tell us about exoplanet demographics. Right now, we're mostly finding big planets close to their host stars that are hot, hot Jupiter-type planets, super Neptunes, planets like that are very close to their stars, planets that are not like those in our own solar system. What Roman will be doing is we'll be better sampling that exoplanet diversity to tell us how frequent other planets like those in our own solar system form. So perhaps with Roman, we can then better predict how frequent solar systems like our own form out there in the universe, and perhaps also how frequently Earth's form out there in the universe. And that can give us a better idea of how frequent habitable planets form as well. So to do this, Roman will be using something called the gravitational microlensing method. For observing a star, maybe towards the center of our own galaxy, that star emits light. For lucky, a foreground star will pass in front of us and that background star, and the gravity of the foreground star will lens or focus the background star's light onto the Earth. It's like a magnifying lens. It takes that light from that background star and it causes the background star to appear to increase here in brightness, you can see in the bottom right. If that foreground star also has a planet around it, you'll see a bump in brightness, not only from the star, but also it's fairly cut off here for folks in the room, but you'll also see a little bump in brightness from the planet as well. So you can use the microlensing method to discover foreground stars, but also planets around those stars as well. Cool thing about this method is it also helps us find things like free floating planets called rogue planets, or also free floating black holes as well. So this method is really, really cool because it helps us find cooler planets. Here in red, at the top left of this plot, this is showing the planets that we're typically observing today. These are planets that are close to their host star. So the orbital distance is very close to their host star. Fractions of AUs, their orbital periods are days, if not hours or minutes in some cases. These planets are also very large. They are Jupiter-sized masses or larger. What Roman will do was we'll find planets more like stuff here out in the blue. Planets that are farther from their star, planets that are smaller in mass as well. We can start finding things that are more akin to Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Venus, Earth, Mars, and perhaps even some moons like the size of Ganymede. So this will help us really fill out this parameter space and help us better understand how frequently planets like those in our solar system form out there in the rest of the universe. For this, oh yeah, go ahead.
Oh yeah, could you tell us what the axes are? It's kind of small to read.
Yeah, sorry. So on the x-axis, this is orbital distance from the star. So that's an AU. So the Earth is at one astronomical unit. Jupiter is at like five. Earth masses is on the y-axis here. So Earth is at one Earth mass. Jupiter is about 100 Earth masses or so. Okay. So we're mostly finding stuff with the transit method, which I'll talk about in a second. Planets that are in close to their host stars and planets that are larger in size. Microlensing is more sensitive to planets that are farther away, farther orbital separation, more AUs, but also smaller masses as well.
It appears the masses are logarithmic.
Yes, this is a logarithmic plot. Otherwise, it would look crazy.
Yeah.
All right. Great questions, folks. Thanks. But the microlensing method, the way we get these observations is also sensitive to help us observe and discover planets using the transit method. And this is the method that I personally specialize in during my PhD and as a scientist as well. The transit method is quite simple. If we're observing a star, if we're very lucky, that star will have a planet around it. If we're even luckier, that planet will occasionally pass in front of its host star and block out a portion of the star's light, causing the star to appear to dim. And the size of the planet is directly proportional to the amount of light that's blocked out. The bigger the planet, the bigger the dip in light when the planet passes in front of the star. So just by measuring that dip in brightness, we can directly measure how big that planet is relative to its host star. And this is actually about 1% transit depths. I have folks in my citizen science project that I'd love to come back and talk to you all about and sign you up for. We have people using 2.5-inch telescopes to observe these transits, even from light polluted areas like Southern California. So any of y'all, even from the district area, can use your small telescopes and help us observe transiting exoplanets. This method also allows us to study a planet's atmosphere. I'll talk about that in a future talk, maybe sometime. And this method has been used to discover most of the planets we know to date. So this method, the transit method, is what gives us, again, these planets out here in red. So one other cool thing about Roman is, let's actually, I won't be able to do the sound, so let's do this. It enables us also to take direct imaging. So there's a really cool animation that explains how direct imaging works. As again, when I talked about earlier, the problem with trying to directly image an exoplanet is that it's vastly outshone by the light of its host star. But if there's a way we can block out the light of the star, we can perhaps resolve the light of the planet orbiting around that star. We can simulate a solar eclipse. We can do that with instrumentation by putting something in the way called a coronagraph. We can then put a little LEO stop around it to block out any direct refracted light around our coronagraph. And we could start to improve our seeing here, to improve our image. It's still a little hard to see these exoplanets, though. And that's because there's aberrations of light in the instrumentation. Because we can only build these telescopes, these machines, these instruments only so accurately here on Earth. So what we can do is we can actually activate our deformable mirrors, very thin mirrors with pistons or actuators behind them, to help to correct for the aberration in the light path. And we can actually correct for it, and we can actually improve upon the seeing in our image. On Earth, we use deformable mirrors to correct for the aberration of light due to the Earth's atmosphere. In space, we use it to improve upon the optics of the telescope, sort of like putting on a pair of glasses. And we can sort of see now there's our two exoplanets orbiting around our star by using a coronagraph, by using that stop, and by using as well those deformable mirrors. So that technology has yet to be demonstrated altogether in space. And we'll do that for the first time with the Roman coronagraph as a technology demonstration, and then apply that for future missions launched by NASA in the next few years. And right here's some actual real data. So this is an animation of about 7 years of data. Right here at the center of our image, that is our star HR 8799. This is data taken by Gemini. You can see the coronagraph is blocking out a majority of the star's light. Some of it still diffracts around that coronagraph mask, showing a speckle pattern. You can still see these little four little blips of light here, and you can see them moving over 7 years. This is a movie of an extrasolar solar system. We're observing these planets orbiting around their star in real time, and I am so excited, and I cannot wait to hopefully make movies like this with a coronagraph on Roman.
That's pretty amazing.
It is absolutely amazing. Remember when I saw this GIF when I was a grad student and I was observing with the transit method? I've always been super jealous of these folks. They can actually see what they're observing. That's cool. They can take a photo of it. So now I'm very lucky that I get to work on this instrument now today. Question in the back.
How close in do you think you'll be able to get?
So it depends on the distance of the star relative to us. So we're able to observe an angular separation 6 to 9 lambda over d. So that's 6 to 9 times the wavelength of light over the diameter of the telescope. So in the order of milliarc seconds, I believe. I'm forgetting math on a Saturday night, unfortunately. Sorry.
And you try to focus on some of the more brighter candidate stars.
Yeah. So we'll be looking at stars around Vmega 6 or brighter. Those are all going to be nearby stars. We'll be orbiting or looking at Jupiter analogs. So to put an orbital separation, roughly about 5 AU. This method right here, they're observing maybe inwards or outwards of 20 AU or so in this image. Question front.
I volunteer on Friday afternoons at the Air and Space Museum.
My favorite museum in the world. Not going to kid.
Yes.
Not going to lie.
And I go between different topics, either SDO images or gravitational lensing black holes. It just so happens that yesterday I was talking about exoplanets,
Yeah.
and we had a little
Lego device there
Oh,
where
yeah.
we had planets going around.
Don't worry. Yeah, yeah.
Star.
Those are great.
And we also talked about Exoplanet Watch.
Oh, thank you.
And well, and being a member of AAVSO,
ABSO,
I
yeah.
also mentioned the AAVSO.
ABSO is great. Well, I would love to come out of the Smithsonian and give a talk and talk to folks. That'd be incredible. I'd love to do that. I love giving these talks. Yeah, in the back or in the middle.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the actual sensor detector of the chorograph? Like, it's probably, I imagine, a really, really, really small sensor with a really, really tight angular resolution, yeah?
Yeah, so I'm forgetting the exact size of the detector. It's much smaller than WFI's detectors. It's an E2V by Teledyne. It's made by Teledyne E2V. It's what's called an EMCCD. It's an electron multiplying CCD. With these exoplanets, we're observing about one photon, I think a minute. It's a very, very low rate, the amount of light we're getting from these exoplanets because they're so much dimmer and farther away from us. Mm-hmm. What's cool about this detector is it has a very high readout amplifier. So we can actually amplify the signal over the noise, like the read noise in particular. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is since we have such a low SNR, systematics in the system, like read noise, for example, usually washes out the signal. So to do that, we have on the amplifier a very high amplifier that multiplies that signal and effectively makes the read noise close to zero. But in so much of how physically big and the angular size, I'm honestly forgetting right now. But it's on the website if you want to look. Yeah.
I noticed, like, so the background stars and galaxies and whatnot are not appearing in that image. Do you electronically remove that through a mask?
That's because there's the alien spacecraft that we have to remove from the photo. That's a joke, everyone. Sorry. Forget, I'm a government employee, so I can't make jokes like that anymore. yeah, so what we try to do is we try to observe things that are very, that don't have a lot of stellar neighbors, for example, and there aren't in binary pairs, so we can better subtract off the noise. If there's another nearby object, like another star or a galaxy, mm-hmm. that'll add noise to the system and make it harder to then pull up and extract the signal of the planets. Great question. You folks are really keeping my toes. This is like the best astronomy club I've ever talked. I'm not even kidding. I'm getting the best questions here. Yeah, in the middle.
So this is a separate optical path for mm-hmm. this device. But
yeah.
It's still the same primary mirror.
Same primary mirror. It's just picking off from the primary mirror at a slightly different location. So here's the primary mirror. The coronagraph is over here. And then WFI, the wide field instrument's over here. So it's picking off at different parts of the primary mirror. Right. So today with ground-based telescopes, we're able to do direct imaging. We're able to do it a little bit also with as well with Hubble and James Webb. We're mostly looking at planets that are big, bright, far from their host star, 100 AUs or farther, twice the orbit of Pluto. What the coronagraph will do is it'll push us inwards to smaller planets, at least more temperate, cooler planets, closer to their host star, about 5 AU from their host star. And the reason we care about observing more Jupiter analogs because that gets us down to where we want to be, to eventually, what I really care about is looking for Earth-like planets and looking for life. Because I'm a massive Star Wars fan, folks. I want to ride the Millennium Falcon. In order to do so, I find like one of the docking bays. That'd be awesome. It'd be great to go to Mos Eisley, as long as I don't lose an arm. Anywho, sorry, happy Star Wars Day, belatedly, by the way. Right, so that'll give us that technology demonstration. With
one of your ships out at the Air and Space Museum.
Yeah. So Roman's capability is given that it's also in the infrared. It'll also be able to look for smaller bodies in our solar system, such as Kuiper Belt objects or cloud objects mm-hmm. that are more more emissive in the infrared. So that'll help us with that. So Roman will not only be Planet Nine, maybe, who knows? But Roman is not just a pure astrophysics mission. It can actually help us do planetary science as well. Roman will also be looking at stars by the billions. So right here, a little cut off in the room, unfortunately, but on the right-hand side are some Hubble images, trust me. it's showing, for example, here's a supernova, stellar death. Actually, that might be a planetary nebula. There's also stellar life, all in this part of this nebula. So these are all individual photos taken with the Hubble Space Telescope. And that takes Hubble multiple pointings to look at a star when it's being formed, or when it's living, or when it's dying. With Roman, there's the giant field of view here in orange. We can point towards a nebula and observe the entire life cycle of a star in a single exposure. Roman will also be looking towards the center of our own Milky Way galaxy. So here is actually the crowded core of our own Milky Way galaxy. We'll look at billions upon billions of stars to look for microlensing methods, to look for new exoplanets, to look for the transits, to look for free-floating planets, for black holes as well, to also look for variable stars. Folks in the AVSO have been looking at variable stars. Look for eclipsing binaries, for Cepheids, for everything towards the center of our own Milky Way galaxy. They'll also observe these stars orbiting around Sagittarius A star, our supermassive black hole, the center of our own Milky Way galaxy. Right here, this is the Andromeda Galaxy M31. These background images right here, these were made by the Hubble Space Telescope. It took Hubble 4 years to observe half of M31. The entire collage, the mosaic of all M31 was just released a few months ago by Hubble. Roman can do the same thing, observe half of M31 in just two pointings. So what took Hubble 4 years to do, Roman could potentially do it in just a few minutes. What's compelling about that is that Roman is not only going to be observing stars in our own Milky Way, they'll be observing stars in other galaxies. It can look at stars being formed. It can look for, you can barely see, there's a small extinction cloud right here. We can actually see stars being born and dying and the gas and dust in other nearby galaxies as well. You get a question in the back.
I'm just, in your imagery there, will you be dithering the field of view a little bit to fill in the gaps?
Yes.
Okay.
Question was online. Will we be dithering a little bit to fill in the gaps? Depending on the survey, they will be doing some dithering to fill in those gaps between the CCDs, exactly, or the H4RGs. We'll also be looking at galaxies by the million. Oh, yeah, question.
So you're capturing an enormous amount of data. Do you have AI tools, or what? Are you capable of analyzing all of this data?
Am I personally capable of it? No, definitely not. No, folks are, there's actually a giant scientific community that's building the tools right now, and they'll be leveraging for sure AI and machine learning to help step through the data. But there's a terabyte of data coming down a day. I would expect that there'll be people across the world that is either doing it more like a classical way of analyzing the data and, you know, by hand in a detailed way, or using their own machine learning and AI tools across the world to also analyze the data. Yes.
So, not that maybe you guys like this universe?
Yeah. So, there are potentially will be some awesome citizen science projects that help us also step to the data and analyze it as well. So, folks in the room can help us analyze data from Roman, like you might have on other universe tools, such as a Galaxy Zoo, for example. Great questions, folks. All right, galaxies by the millions. So one cool thing about Roman is it really makes things that are rare more commonplace, right? So let's say that there is an event that happens one in a million, right? Like something that happens around a star, one in a million. Roman will be looking at billions of stars. So if we're observing billions of stars, that one in a million thing starts to happen hundreds of times. So it enables to make things that are rare more statistically significant, so we can learn a lot more about them. So we'll be looking at galaxies by the millions. Right here, for example, is Rubin's galaxy. At the top is a picture of it with the Hubble Space Telescope. Question about Rubin is, does it have satellite galaxies? So just like on our own Milky Way galaxy, we have large and small Magellanic clouds, we have globular clusters. Do those exist on other galaxies as well? Well, right here in purple is the extent that Rubin's halo could be. And that's about the size in the center of one Hubble image. So we can image not only Rubin, the galaxy, at Hubble precision, spatial resolution, SNR, we can also simultaneously look for things around in its halo as well. And then just like what I showed with the birth and life and the death of stars, we can do something similar for galactic diversity as well. We can point Roman to this part of the sky, looking for spiral galaxies, barred spirals, dwarf ellipticals, irregular galaxies, ellipticals, all those types of galaxies we can get in a single snapshot where it would normally take multiple Hubble pointings to look at. So we can start to take a census of different galaxy types to estimate or understand how frequent galaxies like our own Milky Way, our own spiral galaxy, form out there in the universe. And maybe that'll tell us something about how likely it is that planets also form out there as well. So right here is one of my favorite images taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. This is the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. Hubble sat at this really pretty devoid, blank part of sky for a few hundred hours. In this image, there are only four stars. Five, I think. Five. One, two, three, four, five. For folks online, it is whoop, one, two, three, four, five. You can tell there's stars because you can see that lovely diffraction pattern, that sort of cross pattern. Everything else in that image is a galaxy. There are thousands of galaxies in that small patch of sky, about the size of a grain of rice, held at your arm's length. So that's the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. In this one patch of sky, we thought nothing was going on. We see thousands of galaxies. Let's now shrink this down to the field of view of Roman. So if Roman were to do the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, you can imagine hundreds of thousands or millions of galaxies that Roman could discover simply by its large field of view. So I'm really hoping that someone will be using Roman for an ultra deep field. And actually, we might be doing for one of our core community surveys. We'll also be looking into fundamental physics. So for example, Roman's capability will enable us to look back about 11 billion years to 8 billion years, very nicely complementing James Webb, which can go a bit farther to his larger primary mirror and longer wavelengths, as well as ground-based surveys. But one of the main science drivers from Roman is to look for type 1a supernovae. These are supernovae that form when a white dwarf accretes enough mass where it goes supernova. It happens at the same mass, and all that mass is converted into energy. So the same amount of mass is converted into energy, E equals mc squared. The same amount of energy is always produced. So these things are all the same brightness. So they're called standard candles. So if something is, if it's type 1a supernova, it's very dim, you can know it's very far away. If it's very bright, you know it's very close. So we can use type 1a supernovas to help us measure the distances to galaxies, for example. This is important because this enables us to measure how far away galaxies are from us. And combined with spectroscopy from the wide field instrument, we can measure the Doppler shift of these galaxies and measure the distance of these galaxies and their acceleration. We know that the universe is expanding. And not only is it expanding, it's accelerating. And we have no idea why. Absolutely no idea. And we think it's due to something called dark energy. It interacts by pushing things apart, by repelling them, causing these galaxies to speed up. But we have no idea other than that. And something is doing that. But with Roman, we can start to take a budget and sort of see where dark energy is in the sky. Similarly, we can also look for something called dark matter. So at the center of this image right here, this is by Hubble, there's this cluster of galaxies. In the background, we would not normally see, but you can see these little blue splotches, those blue lines. That's a blue galaxy in the background behind this cluster of galaxies. The cluster of galaxies is bending and diffracting that light and lensing it towards us. This is called gravitational lensing. Just like with gravitational microlensing, where the foreground star focuses the light of the background star, galaxies can also lens the light of background galaxies. So if we can observe the shapes of these galaxies and how they're sort of altered by gravity, we can measure the mass of these objects in the sky. And when we do, we actually find that there's a lot more mass here than what we can see by eye. So there's a lot of hidden mass that interacts gravitationally with light, and that's it. And that's called dark matter. What's even more freaky is that dark matter, dark energy, is about 90% of everything in the universe. So everything we can see in our entire world is a very minuscule part. So there's a lot, 95, 95%, thank you. So there's a lot more out there that we have no idea what's going on, but Roman will help us understand, hopefully, something behind these two elusive sources. And to use a very trite sort of saying, we can expect the unexpected with Roman, just like with Hubble. You know, we've made all these amazing discoveries, James Webb, when it was launched in the first few months, if not years, every single observation by James Webb completely revolutionized the field, and we can expect the same from Roman. Some folks are even predicting that just like with Hubble and James Webb, Roman will produce Nobel Prize physics and discoveries, which is pretty amazing. What I'm really excited about is just about 3 weeks ago, we finally released, or just released, honestly, Roman's three core community surveys. So all that amazing science about exoplanets, cosmology, general astrophysics, and the infrared will be enabled by these three surveys. So now we know what Roman will be observing to achieve those scientific cases. Roman, again, is different than James Webb and Hubble, where you write a proposal, you ask for time to do your science. About 80% of Roman's time will be these core community surveys that have been built and designed by community input. People wrote white papers, people gave science pitches. They said, hey, I think that Roman's capabilities are great, and therefore we should do these compelling science cases. Folks together looked at all the input from the entire community and said, this is how we should design these three surveys to address that science and the science impact are recommended to us by the community. We have our Galactic Bulge Time Domain Survey, we have our High Latitude Wide Area Survey, and our High Latitude Time Domain Survey. So our Galactic Bulge Time Domain Survey, this is what we'll be discovering those tens, if not hundreds of thousands of new exoplanets. We'll be surveying a part of the sky about 8.5 full moons across, these five fields just off the center of the Milky Way, as well as one towards the galactic bulge, the very center of our own Milky Way as well. It'll look for planets with the microlensing method, the transit method. It'll look for transients, variable stars, for example, eclipsing binaries. It'll discover free-floating black holes. It'll expect this thing to discover tens of those as well. It'll also study the center of our own Milky Way galaxy, like Sagittarius A star, those planets, those stars orbiting around the supermassive black hole at the center of our own Milky Way. The other surveys, the High Latitude Time Domain Survey, this will be looking at two fields of view, one in the Northern Hemisphere and one in the Southern Hemisphere. It'll be looking outside of the plane of our own Milky Way galaxy to look outside the obscuring gas and dust in our own Milky Way. And it'll be doing this in a survey area of about 90 full moons over various photometric filters and spectroscopy as well to take movies effectively outside of our own Milky Way galaxy, looking for supernovae, those type 1a supernova, transients, galaxies, and dark energy as well. And then lastly is our High Latitude Wide Area Survey. So this again will also be looking outside of our plane of our own Milky Way to look more distant in the sky. It'll be doing it primarily through photometry, and the largest survey will be through H-band photometry in the infrared. It'll be it'll be 12% of the entire sky, or 25,500 full moons. So again, Hubble has been in space for 35 years. Hubble has imaged 0.01% of the full sky. Roman will observe 12% of the sky in 5 years. And it'll be doing this over the entire mission, over the five-year nominal mission. It'll be looking at dark energy, matter, galaxies, solar system objects, like I said before, and also some objects in our own Milky Way galaxy as well. So this is a ton of data. As we talked about before, for Roman, it's 1 terabyte of data a day, one computer's worth of data being downlinked every single day from Roman to ground stations. The data, the images themselves will be 0.5 gigabyte big. This will all be hosted in the cloud. I cannot work with Roman data on my own laptop because it's just not good enough for that. Just the data images are so big. A lot of us will be interacting with Roman data on the cloud. And this is great, actually, because you don't have to have an amazing computer to access and analyze and study Roman data. You can remotely connect to a server anywhere in the world, and you can interact with Roman data. And again, any of you can get access to that data as quickly as I can, and I work on the mission. So for comparison, Roman, about 20,000 terabytes over its five-year lifetime. Hubble, in its first 30 years, was 172 terabytes. Roman, fun fact, was got 100 over 172 terabytes just on testing on ground-based data alone in just a few months. Again,
Roman in its first year of operations will do what will take Hubble 1,000 years to complete. All right, so with that, I'm going to leave you with my favorite image from the Hubble Space Telescope. This is the Pillars of Creation. When I saw this as a kid in the early 90s, I was really inspired, and this is one of the reasons that I became an astronomer, is because I looked at this image where there's a stellar, stars are being formed in real time. These are stellar nurseries with these little stars forming at these edges of these pillars, and perhaps around these stars are also planets being formed. And that's what made me just blew my mind. Made me want to become an astronomer. I wanted to work on space-based telescopes. But if we were to look at this same sort of field of view with Roman, which is here in white, we can actually see the larger picture. We can see the Eagle Nebula behind it. And we can see that Pillars of Creation at the same sensitivity, the same resolution as the Hubble Space Telescope. Again, Hubble quality science 1,000 times faster. So with that, I've talked way more than necessary. I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you again for your patience and time. Appreciate it.
About funding, you talk about a 5-year mission. Are you subject to annual appropriations, or is there already a 5-year funding for the mission?
Well, everyone in NASA and every government agency has yearly budgets that happen. So we have a nominal 5-year mission lifetime. We're hopefully going to be around for longer, but yeah, things can always change all the time. Well, if you want to donate some money to me, I'll take your paychecks. That'd be great too.
I have a Venmo. Just kidding.
Well, speaking about money and the current administration is famous for slashing all kinds of things without a whole lot of justification. What is likely to be the story here?
So the question was about the current budget that's out and the story here. Honestly, I know as much as everyone here, and some of you actually probably know more than I do. We only know that the president has released the budget, but it's up to Congress at the end of the day to really approve the budget or not. So Congress holds the power of the purse strings. So speaking as a NASA employee, hopefully Congress will be very supportive of Roman. And even in the hearings of Jared Isaacman, who has been the appointee for NASA to be the new head of NASA, in his congressional hearings, he even said that he was in support of Roman flying, because it's all there. It's just down the road, just down Kenilworth Avenue, basically, just a few miles away. It's all there at Goddard, and we're on track not only to launch on time, but also early. Roman is on budget and it's on time. And if we launch in October 26, we'll save money as well. So it really shows how much NASA and Goddard and other space agencies are across the US, how much we've really built upon the amazing heritage and foundations of Hubble and James Webb and learned our lessons to make sure that Roman is on time and on budget. Great question, thanks. Yeah.
What kind of science do you guys want to do within the solar system?
What sort of science might we do in the solar system? Honestly, anything. So anything you can do with photometry in the infrared, you can do with Roman. So I would expect Roman to help discover objects out there in the solar system, such as in the Oort cloud or the Kuiper belt, for sure. At the very, very least. We'll be doing that likely with the high latitude wide area survey. That's one of the main things, is looking for events or transient events that haven't been observed before. Potentially it'll also discover things the high latitude time domain survey as well. Yeah, great question. Yeah.
I remember you were going to talk about the reason behind the logo of the pole in the Roman.
Thank you.
That's my question number one.
Right.
The Roman growth, right?
So right here, there is exactly, and there is the WFI here, the little waffle or space invader shape. And then O is actually the chronograph. So we're blocking out the light of the star. Resolve the light of the two little planets around it.
Because there is a slide. You could make that out on the slide.
Yep.
Slide, but light converging.
Yep. Yep. And so we have both instruments here, WFI and the chronograph. Yeah. Your second question?
The question that I had was, I remember you said that the actual spatial resolution, in terms of like, the angular resolution of the telescope was the exact same as the Hubble.
Yep.
Like the resolution itself is not higher. It's just the field of view that's way bigger.
Field of view is bigger, and actually we have slightly better sensitivity, SNR, than Hubble, because our throughput is slightly higher as well. It's the same angular resolution because our primary mirror is the same size, but then due to the design of the faster focal length, so the shorter focal length, in addition to the larger WFI, that Space Invader shape, we have a larger field of view as well. So
right,
it's a lot of things in concert. Sorry.
You're actually using the entire angular resolution potential of the mirror because you have way smaller pixels and everything around.
So our pixel size in terms of their angular resolution is the same as Hubble. Yes. So if you look at the size and angular resolution of a single pixel on Roman and compare that to Hubble, they're the exact same size as project on the sky in the back.
Are you going to be working with, I guess it's the Vera Rubin ground-based telescope? Is that, are you complementary?
Yeah.
Or coordinating or?
Yeah. So the question online was, how does Roman coordinate with Rubin? And the answer is for sure, it is. So Rubin will be doing a larger survey of the sky than Roman, but Roman will be doing it at higher sensitivity and higher spatial resolution because it's in space. So they're very complementary to each other. Rubin is like a giant fisheye lens compared to Roman's fisheye lens, if you want to think about it that way. And there's actually monthly calls to help sort of strategize on how best to use both of those telescopes in concert to help basically leverage one off the other, to complement one versus the other.
Great question. Also an NCA member.
Oh, nice. I think I saw you first. Go ahead.
Go ahead. So, very complicated question.
Oh, what God. Skip. Next.
What's going to be the expected diffraction pattern on the stars?
What is the expected diffraction pattern on the stars? It's going to... Oh, that's a great question. Let's see if I have a picture of the... Here we go. Secondary mirror. So the secondary mirror is held together as spiders, just like on Hubble. Hubble, there's the 1, 2, 3, 4. James Webb has 6, I think. Roman will have 12, will be diffraction pattern, because we have 2 spiders here, 2 spiders here, and 2 spiders here. So it's not just one, you know, it's 3, it's pairs of 2. And around each spider or thing strut that holds the secondary mirror in place, you have 2 diffraction spikes. So Roman's diffraction pattern will also look very telltale compared to James Webb and Hubble. So you can look at an image and know right off the bat if it came from one of those 3 telescopes. Good question. I think you were next, actually.
Oh, okay, so you mentioned you went over dark energy.
Yeah.
But I was wondering, will Roman be able to shed any light on the Hubble tension in dark energy?
Is that a pun on purpose?
I think it's a general pun, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, potentially. We'll see. I don't know. We'll have to see when Roman flies. Potentially, yes. I mean, honestly, so it's going to be that Hubble sensitivity, but that giant field of view and then the infrared resolution or wavelengths. We'll expect data that we're expecting of Hubble, but just a lot more, larger in the sky.
It has potential of a lot in physics.
Yeah, for sure. And that's why we can expect the unexpected from Roman, quite honestly. That's why it's difficult for me to answer your question, because you know, folks have been designing to answer questions about dark energy and dark matter, and we're designing it to answer these questions, and we'll see when it flies if we are able to answer those questions or not. We're here.
So I almost have a good question, but I was just going to ask, had any more to say about, you know, understanding the nature of dark energy and dark matter with the information that's going to have the number of galaxies, the size of the universe, that's...
Yeah, so we won't be able to understand necessarily what dark energy or dark matter are at the end of the day of Roman. We'll be able to map out dark matter across the sky, at least for a giant portion of the sky, thanks to our high latitude wide area survey. So you can actually sort of see where dark matter occurs, right? Is it tied to galaxies? Potentially it can give us maybe some insight. There's actually a paper a few months ago that said potentially it could be very small black holes that we haven't accounted for. Perhaps Roman could sort of give us more information about it. Whether or not it actually definitively says what dark matter is, who knows? But at least it'll be able to tell us the distribution of dark matter across the sky. With dark energy, it'll allow us to better measure the expansion rate of the universe by looking at it over various redshifts. We could look at the expansion rate of galaxies nearby and far away, and get a better understanding of how the universe is expanding and accelerating. So we won't necessarily know what dark energy is. We'll be able to better understand its impacts and how it plays into things as well. So
will still likely be mysterious.
Any online questions? I don't see anything yet.
Oh, I see some in the some things in the chat.
That was relating to...
Oh, the elections. Perfect. Not me.
Good. Yeah, no.
Any final questions at all? I also have some Roman swag up here that I'll be handing out. So I have stickers and bookmarks and patches. Oh, yeah.
I just have one.
One more question in the front.
Hopefully. Maybe a bit too much to ask from Roman, but you detect some exoplanets, possibly something that's in the habitable zone for that star. Would you... Is the telescope expected to do any spectroscopic studies to identify any amino acids or monosaccharides or anything like
that? Yeah, so for the microlensing method, it's a one-and-done sort of thing. We rely on that perfect geometry where the front foreground star passes in front of the background star and just sort of serendipitously causes that microlensing event to happen. With the coronagraph, though... we'll be looking at least initially, the plan right now is to look at systems that we know have planets around them. And the coronagraph has photometry on board, also has polarimetry on board, as well as spectroscopy. And the spectrograph on the Roman coronagraph will enable us to look for methane on these planets. It'll also look into clouds and hazes as well, mostly in the visible light. So the coronagraph will be sort of demonstrating that technology of doing spectroscopy in space for the first time ever, to look in the atmospheric composition of these planets and then adapt that to have worlds, which will be having an even larger expansion of its capabilities. It'll be at least a James Webb sized mirror or larger, and it'll have a coronagraph on board that'll be in the visible and the infrared and maybe the ultraviolet as well. So we can look at more wavelengths.
Which one was that?
That's the Habitable Worlds Observatory. That's NASA's next flagship mission that's being designed right now, and it'll be launching hopefully in 15 to 20 years from now. Cool. Thanks, folks.
Okay. So, how are the skies?
Good enough for me to set up the scope for at least the moon.
Yeah.
And so, I'm going to stop recording and we're going to log off. And thank you. We'll see everyone next month. Remember, next month we do have more of the science fair presentations. Okay. So we'll see you next month.
Appreciate it. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Free stuff, so I'm gonna take it home.
Sure.
Bye.
This is it'll be on the what?
By the way.